This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
The subcommittee hearing on unidentified anomalous phenomena, or UAPs, will come to order. Welcome, everyone.
Back in July, at a special hearing in the US Congress, a former intelligence officer called David Grush, once part of a task force created to look into what used to be called UFOs, gave evidence that caused a sensation in America.
Mr. Grush, finally, do you believe that our government is in possession of UAPs?
Absolutely, based on interviewing over 40 witnesses over 4 years.
And where?
I know the exact locations, and those locations were provided to the Inspector General.
It was evidence that, whatever its accuracy, both created and reflected a growing and serious debate from astrophysicists and astrobiologists to policymakers about what, if anything, is out there. That is, anything alive and anything civilized. So, as 2023 turns into 2024, what is the state of our understanding about whether or not we are alone in space? Ignore the door to the TARDIS, but instead step inside the briefing room and together we'll try to find out. Firstly, let's dig a bit deeper into recent news about possible extraterrestrial activity and the government's role in investigating UFOs. Dr. Maggie Adairin-Pocock is a British space scientist and science educator. Maggie Adairin-Pocock, let's start with David Grush, that former US Air Force officer who now people call a whistleblower. Can you remind us who exactly he is and why was he giving evidence to Congress?
Yes. So, as you say, he was an Air Force officer, but most relevant to this, he served as the National Reconnaissance Officer for the Pentagon's UAP Task Force, which sits under the Department of Defense. Now, UAP here stands for Unidentified Anomalous Phenomena. Now, it's a new term that encompasses your sort of UFOs, unidentified flying objects in the sky, but also explains unexplained objects and events that are observed in the water and in space and in mediums in between. And so I think it is a combination of trying to move away from the sort of the UFO stigma, but also being more encompassing about the sort of things that are being seen. Now, this task force, Grush was a critical part of it, but he left in April 2023. And then he was sort of blowing the whistle on what he had discovered.
So we've got this congressional hearing. And what did Grush actually tell Congress that caused such a lot of interest?
So the statements he made were a number. And the first one he was saying is that the US government conducted a multi-decade program which collected and attempted to reverse engineer crashed UFOs. He also told them that people had been harmed or injured in the course of government efforts to conceal UFO information. And possibly most interestingly, he said that the government had recovered non-human samples, so effectively biological samples of aliens and spacecraft. But now he did go on to say that he hadn't seen these himself, he hadn't seen the bodies or the spacecraft himself. But his claims were based on extensive interviews with high-level intelligence officers. And in his role on the task force, he would have had access to such people.
So that's pretty sensational stuff. And what did the Defense Department, the Pentagon, say in response to Grishy's claims?
Well, this was all pretty controversial and people were sort of, you know, gobsmacked by this. But the Pentagon sort of categorically denied Grishy's claims that there was any sort of cover up. A Defense Department spokesman said that the investigations have not discovered any verifiable information to substantiate claims there is any programs regarding the possession or reverse engineering of extraterrestrial materials that have ever existed in the past or exist currently.
And certainly no non-human biologics.
No, they denied that as well.
People might be cynical about what a Department of Defense might say, but what about other scientists who have been looking into these areas?
The problem is there is no hard evidence here. As scientists, that's what we really like to get our hands on. And so Grishy's claim, it's effectively hearsay. He's saying, I haven't seen it directly, but I spoke to a chap who might have spoken to a chap who says he saw it. And so there's no smoking gun and sort of no substantiated evidence that means that we're in exactly the same position that we were before. And there's just no real step forward.
I'm trying to imagine what it's like to be one of the people on that congressional committee. And I'm just wondering what the reaction from Democrats and Republicans in the House actually was to all this.
Well, it was a firestorm. I mean, this is a whistleblower revealing all. And I think especially this idea that information is being kept from Congress. But even more mind-blowing is, you know, the aliens are out there. We have their ships. We have their sort of biological samples. And so this was sort of a cause a furore. And people said we need to have an investigation into this. And NASA has appointed a director of UAP research to oversee sort of what is going on, using scientific rigor to gather the data, to look at it and analyze it successfully, hopefully.
What else happened at the hearings, the congressional hearings? Were there other reported sightings?
At the hearings, yeah, other sightings were reported. And so I think generally we think of these sightings of things that have happened in sort of, you know, the 1950s, 60s, and but things are still going on today. There was retired Navy pilots who said that they saw UAPs off the Atlantic coast. So these sightings are sort of witnessed by sort of military air crews and commercial pilots whose lives depend on sort of accuracy of identification.
Indulge me a moment, Maggie. What did they describe themselves as having seen?
So he describes seeing a small white sort of tic-tac, you know, like the small sweets, a sort of shaped object close to the ocean surface, sort of moving very erratically like a ping pong ball, moving at speeds which we don't believe we can reach with current technology.
So do you see this very recent appointment of this, what, UFO czar, as we might call it here, as an attempt really just to lift this out of the realm of fevered speculation and to put it back into the realm of let's have a proper discussion about this?
I think so. NASA, they said they want to shift the conversation about UAPs from sensationalism to science. Because with science, you get evidence, you get sort of due diligence. And I think that really is what this needs. Because at the moment, it is still, you know, he said, she said, but not much of sort of physical evidence.
Maggie Adairin-Pocock, what is often called ufology has a vivid history, especially in the United States. Joining me in the briefing room from Burlington, Vermont, is Garrett Graff, journalist and historian and author of UFO, the Inside Story of the US Government's Search for Alien Life Here and Out There. Garrett Graff, when did UFOs really grab the attention of the US public first?
UFOs emerged in the late 1940s, in the summer of 1947, to be precise. In the wake of World War II and the dawn of the Cold War, there was an Idaho businessman in June 1947 who was flying over the Pacific Northwest and spotted 9 saucer-like objects moving at what he said were tremendous speed. He landed, told some friends about it, it got picked up in the media, and kicked off this summer of fascination with flying saucers. Sightings were reported up and down North America, in Canada, across 34 states in the U.S. And the U.S. military and the U.S. government got concerned that summer, not because anyone imagined it was aliens, extraterrestrials, but they worried that it was secret Soviet spacecraft being built by kidnapped Nazi rocket scientists. Because what was the U.S. doing in that summer? We were building our first rockets, our first missiles, with the knowledge of Nazi rocket scientists that we had spirited out of Europe and deposited in places like the Los Alamos National Lab that had been the site of the creation of the nuclear bomb. So there was this real fear in that moment that the Soviet Union was leaping out ahead in the space race with these flying saucers. And the first wave of this fear was entirely a manufacture of the Cold War, not extraterrestrials.
Now, as we go into the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, does that attitude of the US government change at all? And does it begin to run its own programs to try and look at if there is a possibility that what they then call UFOs are a real thing?
Yeah, it becomes this very interesting cycle as it enters the 1950s, because popular culture latches on to the idea that UFOs are extraterrestrial. You begin to see movies coming out of Hollywood, science fiction books purporting that flying saucers are aliens visiting Earth. That inspires more public sightings and public reports that then feeds national security concerns and military investigations and on and on.
Garrett, I suppose the question I want to ask is why the US, though there were sightings in other countries, obviously claimed sightings, it's only really in the United States that this is a big thing. How do you explain that?
I think, you know, in the US, you have both the driver of popular culture in Hollywood movies. And then I think, you know, part of this story is inextricably linked with the rise of conspiracy thinking in the US and the collapse of truth and trust in government institutions in the United States in the wake of Watergate and the Pentagon Papers and the war in Vietnam.
Right. And this suggests a very interesting phenomenon. In 2017, there is this big report about the Pentagon looking at a secret UFO program. Can you tell us a bit about how that story broke and what the response to it was?
So in 2017, you saw some blockbuster reporting by both the New York Times and Politico that made clear that the Pentagon had actually been studying the possibility of UFOs and UAPs and sort of related paranormal phenomenon for a number of years through this secret program. And then it was followed up with reports about these Navy aviators and the videos of their encounters. Really, I think, changed the tone and the tenor of the conversation in Washington, because it gave people the ability to point to serious work being done on this subject. And at the same time, is this huge revolution in our understanding through astronomy of the depth and breadth and scale of the universe as well. And I think that these end up being linked. Because one of the things that we have seen in the last 25 years is that scientists and astronomers now estimate that there are 1 sextillion habitable planets across the universe. That's 1 trillion habitable planets across the universe. And so one of the things that you have just really seen change in recent years is this dawning realization that the math is almost certainly on the side of the aliens. That, you know, one reason I think we're sort of newly fascinated by the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is the realization that however long the odds of life and intelligent life actually end up being, our universe probably actually teems with life and probably even lots of intelligent life.
Which is not exactly the same thing as vindicating the sightings of UAPs or UFOs on our planet. Do you think that we've now moved away from a period of secrecy on the part of governments, including the US government, about what they're looking into, to a period when they've recognized that actually it's going to be better to be transparent about this whole business?
I think we're moving there. I don't think we're quite there yet. And frankly, we are probably in the most sustained period of attention and high-level interest in this subject since that dawn of the flying saucer age in 1947.
Garrett Graff. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, including the episode about colonising the moon, the one on ransomware, and the one on drones in warfare. Back to extraterrestrials. And now I want to understand how close we might be to finding intelligent life beyond Earth. In the Briefing Room, I'm joined by Avi Loeb, astrophysicist and Baird Professor of Science at Harvard University, and Monica Grady, Professor of Planetary and Space Science at the Open University. Avi Loeb, you're an astrophysicist, and in the past you've done a lot of really important work on black holes, exoplanets, and so on. But what got you interested in the question of alien life?
As an astronomer, the last decade was interesting because the first few interstellar objects from outside the solar system, were spotted near Earth. They look different than the rocks we're familiar with in the solar system. The first reported was Oumuamua, an object that passed near Earth, did not collide with Earth back in 2017, the size of a football field. It was given the name Oumuamua, discovered by a telescope in Hawaii called Pan-STARRS. It was most likely flat in its shape based on the reflection of sunlight and was pushed away from the sun by some mysterious force. Didn't look like a typical comet or an asteroid. And then we discovered a meteor from 4 years earlier that the US government satellites spotted, an object that collided with Earth. It was the size of a watermelon, and it exploded in the lower atmosphere over the Pacific Ocean. And the object was moving very fast, faster than 95% of the stars near the sun. It had material strength that is tougher than all space rocks cataloged by NASA over the past decade. So that, altogether, that raised the question in my mind whether any of these two first interstellar objects might be technological in origin. You can call it a spacecraft or a probe that is visiting us from another civilization, maybe Voyager-like object coming close to Earth from another civilization. And I established a scientific project to examine this possibility, the Galileo Project at Harvard University.
Okay, so it was the movement, the shape, all kinds of unusual aspects of this particular phenomenon that made you think it was just simply not the same kind of thing that we'd seen before.
Well, it's basically like going to the backyard and you're used to seeing rocks and suddenly you see maybe something that looks like a tennis ball thrown by a neighbor. And that at least intrigues me enough to doing the hard work of searching for the evidence, and that included a trip to the Pacific Ocean to look after the materials of this interstellar meteor that I described.
Now, Monica Grady, one of the aspects of this whole discussion is that we're talking about things that are not known and things that are open to interpretation and to discussion. So when you look at the same phenomenon, what do you think you're seeing?
Well, certainly I agree with Professor Loeb that the Oumuamua phenomenon was amazing. It was on such an unusual trajectory, nothing that astronomers had tracked or seen before. And the fact that it had come in and was on its way out of the solar system before it was spotted was, you know, a little bit worrisome, really, I think, for lots of people. You know, we think we've got an idea of all the things that are associated with the solar system, and then suddenly this Oumuamua appears, and it's like it's got an official name, which is I-1, which is interstellar object number one. And although it has a very unusual shape and it didn't show any of the cometary exhalations, that still doesn't make it necessarily artificial. We have got quite a lot of interstellar material in the solar system that we know a lot about, because meteorites that come from asteroids contain tiny little grains, diamonds, silicon carbide, graphite, oxides, with very, very unusual compositions, which can be traced to different stars. You can find little fragments of meteorites at the bottom of the ocean with these little bits in them, but it doesn't make them artificial.
Avi, you decided to try and find more evidence about what this phenomenon was by searching the South Pacific Ocean. Can you just explain to us a little bit what it is you might be hoped to be finding which would help you?
We decided to collect the materials from the meteor site. We rented a ship. We had to design a sled with magnets on both sides so that we can scoop the ocean floor and collect those molten droplets, spherules, from the surface of this meteor. We are now finishing the analysis. We found a special type in terms of composition. It looks very different from any spherules that were analyzed before. People are waiting for the final results. So, you know, science is about the work that is done to reveal the answer rather than having an opinion to start with about what it means.
Monica.
I agree absolutely that you need to be investigating unidentified phenomena because we know there's so much out there we don't understand. But one of the things that I do know is that we have tiny spherules of extraterrestrial material that you can find anywhere where you dredge on the bottom of the ocean. The first cosmic spherules, as they were called, were found in 1874. And so we've known about spherules on the bottom of the ocean floor for a long time. We know their composition. We also know that there's a huge amount of terrestrial rubbish down there from industrial smelting, from all sorts of stuff. And so where I part company with Professor Loeb is the idea that you can go to one particular part of the Pacific Ocean and find spherules from an object. I find that very difficult to understand because there are so many other very similar objects there already. And I would urge Professor Loeb to have a look at any gases that these objects contain because they can help give further evidence whether these are terrestrial or extraterrestrial. However, it still does not say whether they are natural or artificial.
We are starting to plan the second expedition. And of course, the composition by itself cannot indeed say anything about whether it's technological or natural in origin. But we are planning to look for bigger pieces of the object with different tools. And if we find a big piece, we should be able to tell the difference between a rock and a gadget. Because
true,
a technological gadget could have buttons on it.
Absolutely true. That's the problem. When you've only got those sort of melted spherules, you know, they haven't got the chassis number, you know, like stamped on them.
Well, what you both depicted is very much obviously a live debate within the community. Monica, can I just take you back a step? Because, of course, this business of trying to look for extraterrestrial life is not new. Most of us have seen the movies with Jodie Foster and so on and the long-established mm-hmm. SETI. Could you tell mm-hmm. us a little bit more about those historic efforts to find alien life?
The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is very specifically looking for an extraterrestrial civilization. And that's what SETI is, and that's what was depicted in the film Contact all those years ago. And it is a very important search. It's the argument that, well, you know, how will we know they're there if we don't look for them? In the early 1960s, the probability of finding an extraterrestrial civilization was formulated by Professor Frank Drake in something called the Drake Equation. Now, what this is it's an expression and it gives an idea of, you know, when we look at the fact that there are 100,000 billion stars in our galaxy, and there are 100,000 billion galaxies in the universe. And we now know that most stars have planets orbiting around them. What are the chances that somewhere in that myriad of potential planets, there is only one Earth that can harbour life? So the search for extraterrestrial intelligence has looked for radio signals. It's looked for optical signals as well. It still goes on. It's a very difficult thing to do because our sky is a big place. It's just a tiny, tiny possibility, but definitely worth following up on.
Professor Loeb, how different is Project Galileo from these efforts in the past?
With respect to Project Galileo, the difference is quite substantial because for the past 70 years, since Frank Drake started searching for radio signals and the current incarnation of the SETI research program was established, you know, no signal was identified from an extraterrestrial civilization. But that's just like searching for a phone call. You can wait for a phone call at home and nobody would call you just because you are listening for a short period of time, at most half a century or so, or up to a century that we had radio technology. But that's one part in 100 million of the age of the universe. And you really need someone to call you exactly when you're listening, because the signals move at the speed of light. So if they were sent 1 million years ago, they are now 1 million light years away. You will not hear them. The other approach that I think was overlooked and that is much more promising is looking for packages in our backyard that could have been delivered from the street. And why is it better? Because all these technological objects like Voyager, the spacecraft that we launch, populate interstellar space. They collect just like plastics in the ocean. They keep accumulating over time. And all we need to do is check our neighborhood and see if there are any objects moving near Earth that could have been manufactured.
It's a very interesting contrast, which is, from the listener's point of view, seems to be a contrast between, as you say, waiting for the phone call or looking around to see if there are any kind of traces on the planet. I want to ask you both something, though, which is, how much progress, Monica, do you think we've made in very recent times technologically to be able to help us with this quest?
We've made incredible progress. Professor Loeb made mention of a Pan-STARRS telescope, which is a set of telescopes which are scanning the night sky in both the northern and the southern hemisphere. And that has returned a huge number of additional asteroids. We know a whole lot more about the population of material which is within the solar system. Through telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope, the Hubble, Chandra, and so on and so forth, we know an enormous amount about the structure of stars and the way they evolve. And by studying life on Earth, we've learned a whole lot more about the different places where life is able to survive and look at the probability of finding life beyond the Earth. So it's all made the most amazing progress.
I just want to come to the end of the program by asking you both almost a kind of philosophical question. You first, Avi Loeb, what difference do you think it would make to us to discover that we could, after all, identify another civilization somewhere else in the bigger, greater universe?
Well, we know from personal experience that finding a partner can give meaning to our existence. So here we are talking about finding a partner in the cosmos. It will not appear to be lonely anymore. Just think about finding a partner that we can ask questions. I mean, I have two questions that particularly interest me. The first is, what happened before the Big Bang? Because that will teach us how to unify quantum mechanics and gravity. And also it touches on our cosmic roots. The second question is, where is the nearest bar where extraterrestrials socialize? I would like to go there.
Monica, what do you feel about this big philosophical question?
It is a really interesting and difficult question because it makes us investigate our own humanity. If we were to be visited by an extraterrestrial civilization, it would rock us to our roots. Really sadly, though, I suspect it won't be in my lifetime.
Monica Grady there with Avi Loeb. My thanks to them and to Maggie Adairan-Pocock and Garrett Graff. And my conclusion? A happy new year to you, wherever in the universe you may be. Here on Earth, we'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producer was Sally Abrahams, the editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was recorded and mixed by Neil Churchill and James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
Hello, this is Marion Keyes.
And this is Tara Flynn.
We host a podcast you might like for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds called Now You're Asking.
Each week we take real listeners' questions about life,
love,
lingerie,
cats,
dogs,
dentists,
pockets,
or the lack of
anything really,
and apply our worldly wisdom in a way which we hope will help,
but also hopefully entertain. Join us, why don't you?
Search up Now You're Asking
on BBC Sounds.
Thanking you.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.